Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission here is, well, pretty simple. You give us the complex stuff, research papers, dense articles, and we pull out the core insights for you.
Yeah, we try to make it digestible, give you the actionable knowledge so you can get up to speed without drowning in the details.
Exactly. And today, we're diving into probability theory, specifically a really powerful technique called Stein's method.
Right. And for this deep dive, our main source is a survey paper that's, you know, aimed at a graduate level audience, people who've seen some probability before.
So the math can get pretty technical under the hood.
It can. But our goal today isn't to get lost in every single equation. It's more about giving you a solid audio overview of the fundamental ideas behind Stein's method, what makes it tick, and maybe more importantly, why it's such a useful tool in the probabilist's toolkit.
Yeah, we want to unpack the logic, the sort of core concepts, and hopefully hit those aha moments without needing a PhD to follow along. Okay, so let's start broad. What is Stein's method, fundamentally?
At its heart, Stein's method is a way to figure out just how close one probability distribution is to another one that we understand well, like the normal distribution, the bell curve.
Mm.
And it goes beyond just saying, oh, they look similar eventually. It actually tries to put a number, a bound, on the error in that approximation right now.
Okay, so it quantifies the difference. It's not just convergence. It's how fast or how well it's converging at a given point.
Exactly. That kind of precision is incredibly valuable for, you know, real-world applications where you need to know how good your model actually is.
That sounds like a big step. Where did it come from?
It originated with Charles Stein. He developed it initially to approximate the distribution of sums of random variables. And the key thing was, it worked even when those variables depended on each other.
Dependency. That's often the tricky part, isn't it? Traditional methods sometimes struggle there.
They really do. So being able to handle sums of dependent variables and approximate them with a normal distribution was a major breakthrough.
But it didn't stop with the normal distribution. Right, that's what makes it so versatile.
Precisely. That's one of the most powerful aspects. The core ideas Stein developed turned out to be incredibly adaptable. People realized you could apply similar thinking to approximate using lots of other standard distributions.
Like what, for instance?
Well, like the Poisson distribution, which is great for counting rare events, or the exponential distribution for waiting times, or even the geometric distribution, you know, for number of trials until you get a success. It's a whole framework.
Okay, a flexible framework. How does it actually do that? How does it quantify the error? What are the main parts?
Generally, there are two main components to the method. First, it cleverly transforms the problem. Instead of directly comparing distributions, it turns the problem into calculating the expected value, like the average, of a specific function applied to your random variable.
A specific function? Like a test?
Sort of, yeah. Think of it as a special test tailored to the target distribution you're aiming for, normal, Poisson, whatever. The paper mentions specific equations that define these test functions. If your random variable, on average, scores close to zero on this test, it means its distribution is close to the target distribution.
Okay, so step one is reframing the distance problem into an expectation problem. What's step two?
Step two is actually figuring out how to calculate, or usually just find a good bound on that expectation value we just talked about.
Uh-huh.
And this is where a lot of the ingenuity comes in. It involves a collection of techniques, often grouped under the name auxiliary randomization, to estimate or bound that expectation. Choosing the right technique depends a lot on the specific structure of your random variable.
Got it. Set up the test, then find clever ways to evaluate the score. The paper mentions Stein's own book title, something like Approximate Computation of Expectations.
Yes, and that title really nails it. Bounding expectations is absolutely central to the whole thing.
And since Stein's original work, this has really taken off.
Oh, absolutely. Hundreds of papers have built on this. The good news is that for many common target distributions, normal, Poisson, exponential, that first step, converting the approximation problem into bounding an expectation, that groundwork has largely been done.
So the foundation is there. Let's maybe dig into some of the key techniques, starting with the original application.
Yeah.
Approximating with the normal distribution.
Okay. So for normal approximation, a key starting point is what's called the Stein equation for the normal distribution. But perhaps more useful in practice is a direct consequence, a result, the paper highlights, which connects the distance how far your variable W is from standard normal directly to the expected value of a specific expression.
The one involving W and this special function, SX.
Exactly that one. It basically gives you a formula. calculate this expectation, and that tells you about the distance between the distributions.
And this function fx, it has certain properties that help control things.
Yes, precisely. There are results about its smoothness and how large it can get, which are crucial for getting usable bounds on the error. So the main challenge then becomes, how do we bound this expectation? Esx, w, w, fx, w. And the answer depends on what w looks like.
Right. Let's start simple. What if w is just a sum of independent random variables?
That's the classic setup. In that case, there are theorems that give you error bounds directly in terms of things like the variances and maybe higher moments, basically, statistical properties of the individual variables you're summing up. It connects the error to the building blocks.
Makes sense. But the real power often lies in handling dependence, as you said. The paper talks about dependency neighborhoods. What's that about?
This is a really neat concept for dealing with variables that aren't fully independent, but where the dependence is somehow localized. You define a neighborhood for each variable, which includes all the other variables it directly depends on or influences.
So anything outside that neighborhood is independent of it.
Exactly. It captures structures where things only interact locally.
How does that help with normal approximation?
Well, there's a key theorem that provides an error bound for sums of these locally dependent variables. The bound typically depends on the size of these neighborhoods, how widespread the local dependence is, and again, on moments of the individual variables.
So even with some local messiness, the sum can still look normal-ish. Mm. And Stein's method tells you how normal-ish based on that local structure.
You got it. And the paper gives a cool example. Counting triangles in random graphs.
Ah, the Erdős-Reni graph.
Right. You can define dependency neighborhoods based on whether triangles share vertices or edges. Then you apply the theorem to see how well the total triangle count is approximated by a normal distribution. It connects graph structure to the quality of the approximation.
Very concrete. Okay, moving through the toolkit. Exchangeable pairs. Sounds intriguing.
Yeah, this is another clever technique. An exchangeable pair is a pair of random variables, say W and W, such that if you swap them, their joint distribution doesn't change. It's a kind of symmetry. And there's a special type called an A-Stein pair, which adds another condition related to the expected change from W to W.
How do these pairs help approximate the normal distribution?
There's a theorem that gives an error bound using properties of this pair. Specifically, it relates the approximation error to how much W and W typically differ, measured by things like the variance of the squared difference conditional on W.
And where do you find these exchangeable pairs?
A really common place is in systems that evolve over time and reach a steady state, like certain Markov chains. Often, the state at one time step and the state at the next form an exchangeable pair if the chain is reversible.
Like the anti-voter model example.
Exactly. The anti-voter model on a regular graph where people flip their opinion based on a neighbor's opposite opinion. In the long run, it reaches a stationary distribution. You can construct an exchangeable pair related to this state and use Stein's method to see how close the distribution of opinions is to normal.
And the error depends on things like the graph structure.
Yes, through the variance of that stationary distribution. Sometimes analyzing a related dual process helps bound that variance, but that's getting a bit deeper.
Okay, another tool. Size bias coupling. What's the idea there?
The size bias distribution is a way to transform a non-negative random variable, say x. You create a new variable, x's, which is kind of like x, but weighted towards larger values. Specifically, the probability of picking a value k is proportional to k times the original probability of k.
So it biases the sampling towards larger outcomes.
Yeah.
Hence the name.
Precisely. And the coupling part refers to constructing the original variable x and its size-biased version x's together on the same probability space in a related way.
And how does this help with normal approximation?
There is a theorem that connects the normal approximation error for x to how close x and x's are, specifically ex is x. If you can construct a coupling where x's is typically not much larger than x, you get a good error bound.
And there are ways to build these couplings.
Yes, especially for sums of non-negative independent variables. The paper gives methods and applies it, for instance, to count isolated vertices in random graphs. You construct a size-biased version of the count and use the theorem.
Interesting. That relates to another technique, zero-bias coupling.
Similar idea, but tailored for variables that have a mean of zero and variance of one. The zero bias transformation creates a related variable W with specific properties. Lemma 3.29 in the paper gives the key property.
Right.
And again, you can construct zero bias versions for sums of independent variables. what's really insightful here is the connection to the classic central limit theorem, the Lindeberg-Feller version specifically.
How so?
The conditions needed for the standard CLT pop out quite naturally when you analyze the zero bias coupling. Essentially, if a certain term involving the zero bias variable goes to zero, then your original sum converges to a normal distribution. Stein's method provides a different perspective on why the CLT holds.
And briefly, these methods often give bounds in the Wasserstein distance, but you can convert those.
Yes, the paper mentions how bounds in the Wasserstein metric, which measures a sort of cost of transforming one distribution into another, can be used to get bounds in the Kolmogorov metric, which is that maximum vertical distance between the cumulative distribution functions. There are standard ways to make that translation, often involving the zero bias transform again.
Okay, that's a solid overview of normal approximation. But you said Stein's method is broader. Let's talk Poisson approximation for count data.
The approach is very parallel to the normal case. There's a Stein equation for the Poisson distribution.
Tailored specifically for Poisson.
Right. And a key result connects the distance between your integer-valued variable W and a Poisson distribution to the expected value of a specific expression, analogous to the normal case.
Using a different test function tailored for Poisson counts.
Precisely. And again, the properties of the solution to this Poisson-Stein equation are known, which helps in bounding the error. The main theorem gives bounds in total variation distance, which is a natural way to compare discrete distributions.
And do the same kinds of techniques apply, like sums of variables, local dependence?
Yes, many of the same ideas carry over. There are specific theorems for sums of independent Bernoulli variables, like adding up indicators of rare events. Think coin flips that rarely come up heads.
Okay.
And the dependency neighborhood idea works too. There's a theorem for sums of locally dependent variables converging to Poisson. The paper uses the example of counting long runs of heads in coin flips.
Head runs.
Yeah, and interestingly, it notes connections to problems like finding patterns in DNA sequences. So real-world applications again.
And size biasing, is that useful for Poisson too?
Very much so. Size bias coupling is actually a particularly powerful tool for Poisson approximation. There's a main theorem giving error bounds via size bias.
Similar to the normal case, construct a coupled variable.
Exactly. And there are results on how to do this, including variations like increasing size bias couplings, which can sometimes simplify things. A major application is counting small subgraphs like triangles or cycles and random graphs.
Right. We mentioned triangles before for normal approximation.
Yes. But often when the expected number of subgraphs is small or moderate, the Poisson distribution is a better fit than the normal, and size biasing is a key technique to prove that and bound the error.
The paper also mentions implicit and decreasing size bias.
Right. Implicit coupling is a way to use the size bias theorems sometimes without explicitly constructing the size bias variable, which can be handy. Decreasing size bias applies when removing an item affects the variable, useful for things like sampling without replacement or the coupon collector's problem.
Coupon collecting. Okay, getting all the different toys from the cereal box.
That classic problem. Stein's method with size biasing provides sharp bounds there.
What about exchangeable pairs for Poisson?
They can be used too, though maybe not as extensively as size biasing in the Poisson context. The framework exists, and applications include alternative proofs for the law of small numbers. That's the idea that binomial probabilities with many trials and low success rate look Poisson. It often involves linking the problem to birth-death processes that stabilize to a Poisson distribution.
Okay, we've covered normal and Poisson. What about, say, exponential approximation? For waiting times.
Yep. Section 5 in the source tackles that. Again, there's a Stein equation for the exponential distribution. The error bounds are often related to the Wasserstein or Kolmogorov distance.
And there's a concept called the equilibrium distribution.
Yes, that's key here. Definition 5.5 introduces it. Theorem 5.6 connects the error bound in exponential approximation to properties of this equilibrium distribution. And interestingly, proposition 5.7 shows you can often construct this equilibrium distribution using...
Let me guess, size biasing.
You got it. There's a close connection. Applications include approximating geometric distributions with exponential ones and analyzing sums of geometric variables.
And branching processes. That sounds interesting.
Yes, a really nice application. It uses Stein's method combined with a size biased tree construction to look at critical branching processes. Think of populations where each individual has, on average, one offspring.
Okay.
Conditioned on the process surviving, the size of the population at large times, properly scaled, converges to an exponential distribution. That's Yaglom's theorem. Stein's method helps quantify the rate of that convergence.
Wow. Okay, nearly there. What about geometric approximation itself?
Section 6 covers this. Useful for number of trials until success. Again, Stein equation, error bounds in total variation distance using properties of the solution.
And size biasing again.
Indeed. Proposition 6.5 discusses the size biased version of a geometric variable, and theorem 6.7 provides error bounds using size bias coupling. An application mentioned is analyzing degree distributions in certain random graph models, like uniform attachment graphs.
So the same core ideas, Stein equation, specific techniques like size biasing keep reappearing, just adapted for each target distribution.
That's the beauty of it. It's a unified framework.
One last area mentioned is concentration inequalities. How does Stein's method help there? That seems a bit different from approximation.
It's a fascinating extension. Concentration inequalities tell you how tightly a random variable clusters around its average value. Stein's method, particularly using a Stein pairs or size bias couplings, can be adapted to prove such inequalities.
Oh.
Theorem 7.4, for example, uses Stein pairs to get bounds on the probability of large deviations. It's applied to sums of independent variables, dependent ones, and even to physical models like the Curie-Weiss model for magnetization.
And size bias, too.
Yes, theorem 7.11 shows how size bias couplings can yield concentration bounds. The head runs example comes up again here, showing how tightly the number of runs concentrates around its mean.
So Stein's method isn't just for approximating distributions, but also for understanding how much they vary.
Exactly. It's a surprisingly versatile set of ideas.
Okay, this has been a fantastic deep dive. If we had to sum up the real power of Stein's method, what's the main takeaway?
I think the key is that it moves beyond just knowing that one distribution approximates another. It gives you a way to measure how good that approximation is. It provides concrete quantitative error bounds.
And it does this using a framework that's adaptable to many different target distributions, normal, Poisson, exponential, geometric, and others, and can handle complex dependencies using techniques like dependency neighborhoods, exchangeable pairs, and these clever biasing methods.
Precisely. Its strength lies in that combination of a general framework turning approximation into bounding expectations and a toolkit of specific techniques to actually compute or estimate those bounds in various settings.
From random graphs to DNA sequences to branching processes,
yeah.
The applications are incredibly broad.
They really are. It underpins rigorous analysis in many areas of probability and statistics.
So, for you listening, the power here is in getting those hard numbers on approximation errors. It makes you think, doesn't it? What other complex systems, maybe ones you work with or study, have underlying probabilistic behavior that we only describe qualitatively right now? Where could applying Stein's method give us that deeper quantitative grasp, telling us how close our models really are? Something to chew on. And if you want the full mathematical story, definitely check out the references in the original survey paper.
Absolutely. Is there a lot more depth there?
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.